This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Watching Servant of the People while simultaneously watching the coverage of the war is kind of like one of those digital images where you slide the cursor from side to side to reveal the before and after. Slide it to the left and the sunny streets of Kyiv are bustling and lively. Slide it right and those streets are a dim, rubble-strewn wasteland. Obviously, in real life, only one of those realities exists now. Our next story is about multiple versions of Ukraine, too. Some from the past, some from the present, all of which existing in one family's shared history. The family is the Fours. Franklin Four, the eldest son and a staff writer at The Atlantic, told the story to Julia Longoria, host of the WNYC podcast, The Experiment.
It's a repeated refrain from Vladimir Putin and his acolytes. Putin has said he wants to, quote,
denazify the Ukrainian government, that they are a liberating force from essentially an oppressive Nazi government.
When I heard Putin say that, I thought about my own journey with Ukraine, because there was a point not so long ago when I would have agreed with him, or, you know, thought that there was some truth to what he was saying, because I grew up with my grandmother's stories.
Franklin's grandma and Vladimir Putin happen to have a similar story that they've told themselves about Ukraine. As you might imagine, they don't have a whole lot else in common.
Now we have Grandma Ethel here. I'm so pleased to have her here.
My grandmother's name was Ethel.
Before she passed away in December 2018, Ethel was a guest on the Martha Stewart Show.
So one cup of matzo meal.
Yeah,
but now
right.
What kind of matzo meal?
Yeah.
What kind?
Straight.
Straight.
Manischewitz, whatever.
Okay. Okay.
She was very warm. She loved to talk to people on the telephone, always in a very loud voice because she wasn't totally convinced of the technology. She had a real bounce in her step, despite having survived so many terrible things.
I came from Europe and I went through the war. I was very lucky. I escaped Hitler.
Yeah, lucky.
Luck and intuition.
My mother came to this country as a little girl. Home had been Ukraine, but they didn't see themselves as Ukrainian. They saw themselves as Jewish. My grandmother viewed the Ukrainians that she knew as Nazi collaborators, and so that was the story that I grew up with.
The purpose of this interview is to add to the oral history of the Nazi Holocaust so that future generations will know what happened. With this knowledge, hopefully, we can prevent any such occurrence in the future.
Could you please tell me your name?
Ethel Kaplan. I was born in 1920, June 15. I had two sisters, and we were very, very close, you know?
The part of Ukraine she lived in had been previously Polish, but then became part of the Soviet Union. She'd been a communist, actually, as a little girl. She liked to talk about how she would go down to wash the family's plates before Passover to make them kosher for the holidays, and that she would go out and sit by the river with the boys who liked her.
I had a lot of friends.
But then she describes one day she saw paratroopers fall from the sky.
A lot of people started running, and the soldiers, and we could see parachutes and airplanes.
And there was a collective state of panic in her town.
Ethel had just turned 21 years old. This was 1941. The Nazis began their surprise invasion of the Soviet Union in June of that year. One of the first places they attacked was what is now known as the country of Ukraine, and what was then known as the Ukraine, or the borderlands, the edge of the Soviet Empire. This was Ethel's homeland.
And she makes a snap decision to run for her life.
What did your mother say to you when you said you were leaving?
She was speechless. She didn't say anything.
Did she try to change her mind?
No.
Why didn't her mom go with her?
Her mother couldn't imagine the worst. If you lived in this part of Ukraine, you were used to pogroms. You were used to invading armies. You'd survived terrible things before. And she couldn't imagine why it would be different this time.
As early as the 1800s, before the Soviets took over, there were riots against Jews in this area known as pogroms, where non-Jews would commit violence against Jewish people, sometimes egged on by Russian police. But Ethel had never witnessed any of this firsthand. So when she saw paratroopers arrive, she was scared. She felt she had to leave.
She had no destination in mind.
We didn't realize what we are doing. We just were running and we just had to survive.
So she's going east. She ends up in Kiev. The whole city is in a state of wartime panic. And she gets to the train station and ends up in Kazakhstan, where she gets assigned to work on a collective farm. There's a radio in the farm, and so she's able to track the progression of the war that way. She gets a sense that the Soviets are pushing back against the Nazis and conquered the swath of Ukraine where her village is. And so she writes a letter to Joseph Stalin asking for permission to be able to visit her town. And although she never heard back from Stalin himself, but she got some sort of response.
They sent me that all my family died.
She hadn't heard from her family during the war. And when she got to the town, she was pulled aside by somebody, a Ukrainian she knew, who told her that her grandfather had gone to pray in the synagogue.
The older Jews, they were praying. So they put a fire and they burned them. They burned him in the synagogue.
The Nazis locked the doors and burnt down the place with him in it.
My younger sister, they killed her in the middle of the street. And my older sister, they didn't even want to tell me what happened to her because it was so terrible.
The Nazis had marched her sister and her mother to the forest outside of the town and forced them to dig a grave and then line the Jews up and shot them so that they fell back into this grave.
This is what they told me. Everybody got killed, every one of them.
It's a lot to absorb for any person to hear all of this in one moment. But on top of that, there was another Ukrainian who told her and said, you know what, I'm telling you something that's going to save your life now. You need to leave because the Nazis may be gone, but their Ukrainian collaborators are still here, and they'll kill you if you spend more than one night in this town.
The last night that Ethel ever spent in her hometown defined how she would tell the story of Ukraine for generations.
That was the story that I grew up with.
It was a story that Franklin and his two brothers knew very well. But there were other parts of their family history that were fuzzier to the brothers. For instance, what had happened to their grandfather? They knew that their grandparents had met after both of them had fled Nazis in Ukraine, but that was about it.
My grandfather, his name was Louis. He died long before I was born, before my brothers were born. He died in 1954, and we didn't really know anything about his life. My grandmother kind of always kept it hush-hush, which should have had a big question mark set next to it.
Slowly, over time, and in a very circuitous way, the brothers began to acknowledge the question mark and to begin to try to find answers. Frank's brother Jonathan wrote a novel about it.
he wrote this magical realist history called Everything is Illuminated, which was a novel that tried to imagine my grandfather's existence. And so that happens and actually gets turned into a movie.
For the brothers, the book and the movie just reinforced the questions that they'd been suppressing. Like, how did their grandfather die so young?
My youngest brother, Josh, went and did a search of death certificates, and he discovered that my grandfather had hung himself in the back of the store that he owned on Euclid Street in Washington, D.C. And there's one other mystery that I think I need to introduce right now, which is that when my mom was 40 years old, just after her 40th birthday, she had a conversation with my grandmother. And my grandmother told her, you know, your father had another daughter and she was killed in the war and was 7 years old when she was murdered. And my mom was 7 years old when my grandfather killed himself. And for my mother, this was like this earth-shattering moment. Like, she was just so gobsmacked by this revelation.
Frank's mom, Esther, started to look for answers herself. Who was this half-sister of hers? How did her dad escape the Holocaust? She had held on to one shred of evidence of her dad from many years earlier.
The photograph. There was a photograph of him sitting with three Ukrainians. One of the Ukrainians was an older man, and we knew that my grandfather had probably been saved during the war by him, but we didn't know much else.
If anyone knew the story of what had happened to Grandpa Lewis, it would be these Ukrainians in the photo. So Frank and his mom started to consider, what if we try and go find these people?
My grandmother was pretty horrified by the idea. She was frankly terrified by the prospect of our going there.
But in 2009, Frank and his mom got on a plane to Ukraine anyway.
And the last thing that she told us on our way out the door was, don't eat their food, which I found to be such a strange warning. Like, what else are we going to do? Like, we just going to eat.
Just going to take some granola bars, yeah.
Protein bars the entire time? Yeah. So we drove into this very small, remote Ukrainian village where my grandfather had lived. And it's one road, maybe 10 houses on each side of the road. And in back of the houses, there's just like fields leading into the forest. And at the entrance to the village, there are three Ukrainians lined up to greet us. And it's really awkward. Like, we're meeting these people for the first time. We think they may be our saviors, but they may not be our saviors. And so do we hug them? Do we shake their hands? They're very, very warm to us, though. And so they take us into their house. It feels like it could have come from 1915. And there's a ledge. And on this ledge, there's a photo, an old photo that's propped up. And she takes it down and she compares it to the photo that we have. And it's pretty clear that the guy who's sitting next to my grandfather is in this photo that she has. This guy had a button on his shirt that was in both photographs. It just looked like it couldn't have been a coincidence. And so my mother and I are starting to get very excited that we may have found the family that saved my grandfather. And we sit down and the granddaughter starts to tell us a story. And she says, you know, I never really heard very much about my grandfather during the war, but when my uncle would get drunk, he would tell this story about how when he was a kid, the family had hit a guy named Label, which was my grandfather's Yiddish name, and that the Nazis had once come to our house and Label was hiding behind a door. And if the Nazis had discovered him, we would have all been killed. And at that moment, the grandson disappears. And he comes back with an old woman. She comes into the room and she runs her thumb over my forehead. And she says, you have your grandfather's brow. And I ask her the question. I was like, so you knew my grandfather? She says, yes, I knew your grandfather. I knew his wife, Zipporah. Then I ask her about my mother's sister. And I said, did you know my mother's sister? And she pointed to the window and she said, yeah, I used to play with her in those fields outside. We would play with a ball. And I said, did you know her name? And she said, yes, her name was Asya. It was like this girl who had been completely lost to history. There was no trace of her in any of the databases of Holocaust victims. We didn't know her name. We didn't think we would ever know her name. It was like we'd rescued her memory. To me, in a way, that's Ukraine. It's like Ukraine is this place where history continues to exist. Like these things that you think are so distant in the past are actually still touchable. That's the moment where my view of Ukraine was completely turned on its head. I realized that these people who threatened to kill my grandmother were also the people who saved my grandfather, and that they'd made the ultimate sacrifice on behalf of a neighbor. I mean, I found myself crying into the arms of this Ukrainian family who I'd only just met, but knowing that I owed them the greatest debt. In 2014, I was editor of the New Republic magazine, and I watched the events of that year. I watched how the people of Kyiv had risen up against the corrupt pro-Soviet government that existed and installed a democracy in the country. And I watched as Vladimir Putin invaded Crimea and then invaded eastern Ukraine. And there was this real struggle for the soul of the country. And the New Republic organized a conference in Kyiv.
The conference took place in May of 2014, just 2 months after Russia had invaded Crimea and eastern Ukraine, a precursor to the violence we're seeing now.
And the city still felt like it was in the middle of a revolution. If you walked into the streets, there were still barricades with tires piled up. You could see buildings that had been burnt down. You could see bullet holes, people who were veterans of the battle still camped out in the central square.
The central square, or Maidan, is where Ukrainians had protested and fought for democracy in their country.
And at that conference, I'd invited Lesya, who was the great-granddaughter of the guy who'd saved my grandfather during the war. She was a student in Kyiv, and she had been in the Maidan as a protester, but she really didn't know much about the Holocaust. It just hadn't been part of her education. And so I went with her to Babi Yar, which is a ravine where the Jews of the city were marched and killed in one of the biggest mass graves in history. Over the course of several days, 30,000 Jews were killed in this ravine. I mean, in a way, I was learning about it as we were walking through. I mean, I knew the basic outlines of it all from before, but she was really learning about it for the first time. And it was incredible to watch her face as she started to comprehend what had happened at this place.
Thank you very much for joining us on this beautiful Monday morning when there is so much else to do.
The next day at the conference, I was on a panel about Ukraine, history, memory, and the future of the country. So I started to tell the story about the guy who'd saved my grandfather during the war.
He would not have survived the war if it were not for his Ukrainian neighbor, David, who was one of the truly righteous Gentiles, and he hid him in his house for a year. And I mention this story in part because the great-granddaughter of the man who saved my grandfather, Lesa, is here in the audience, and she was on the Maidan.
And I found myself just really overwhelmed by the emotion of the moment.
And this has been a very meaningful, a very meaningful experience for her. And it's kind of the beauty of what's happened. What, Lesa? Lesa's here.
And I pointed to her, and the room just kind of broke out in a sustained applause for her. And the organizer of the trip kind of brought her up on stage.
I hope I didn't embarrass you with that. Okay.
And it was just, it was such a moving moment for me because I felt like I was able to publicly acknowledge the debt that I had to her family.
This guy needs a hug. Okay.
When Lesia came to Washington to stay with my mother took her to visit my grandmother. And I think it was actually a touching experience for my grandmother because after all of this time of kind of harboring these kind of terrible memories of Ukrainians, she was able to admit to herself, well, there actually were some good Ukrainians. And it was probably a touching, redemptive moment for her.
So where is Lesa now?
She is in Kyiv. Do you want to get in touch with her?
Yeah.
You know, she may be in her village now. I have to ask my mom.
Hello.
Hi, Esther. It's Julia. I just wanted to call you because it's been such a pleasure talking to your son, Frank. Or
oh,
Franklin. Does he go by Frank? Yes. Or
you know, he used to go by Frankie, but now he goes by Frank. and, you know, Lesa, I don't know if you were able to talk to her.
Yeah, we've been trying to reach Lesa. Have you been in touch?
Yes. Every day. I got something from her today.
What did she say?
Oh, this is February 12th. It was way back. There's tension in Kyiv. We work with foreigners, and a lot of them are leaving. However, Ukrainians believe that everything will be fine. Thank you for email. I couldn't answer earlier because it was a bit crazy. The next one, we're still in Kyiv. Couldn't leave. The next, parents are safe. Kyiv's not in good condition right now. The 26th, she writes, we will stay. Then the next day, she says, we left Kyiv last night by train. Now we're going to our parents' village. We're a bit afraid. It's on the border with Belarus. Thank you for keeping in touch with us. It means a lot right now. And what's really sweet is when she writes, with best wishes from Lesa and your Ukrainian family. They describe themselves as our Ukrainian family. And we write back, as your American family. We offer to take them in. I've told Lesa, you know, if they want to come here, we will sponsor them in a heartbeat, you know, without a moment's hesitation. I feel it's my obligation.
Yeah. And do you have any sense from talking to Lesa, like what her plans are or what's next for her family?
I can't imagine that she knows what's next for her family. This is a huge crisis, and I think you take it day by day, and you do what you can to be a survivor.
Yeah.
Which is what I learned from my mother, who was kind of the ultimate survivor.
Esther, thank you so much.
Okay. I hope you can connect with Lesa.
Yeah, I hope so too. I mean, I think we'll keep trying.
Yeah. All right.
On the Media is produced by Micah Lowinger, Eloise Blondio, Rebecca Clark-Callender, and Max Balton, with help from Aki Camargo. Our engineers this week were Adrian Lilly and Andrew Nerviano. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.